Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's always great joining you at the end of the week. Gives us an opportunity to play that famous game of catch-up and find out what's going on in the world, especially where immigration is concerned. And, of course, so many of the stories that are out there do have a clear nexus with immigration. So we'll get started. But to start out with, I want to tell you about three websites I would love for you to visit. You know, I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but rather than take up lots of airtime today and tell you about my background, I would ask that if you're not familiar with who I am and what I've been up to for the past, hard to believe, more than four decades, I ask that you please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. That's one word. M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. Also, I have videos up on another website that I'm very happy to share with you at talkborder.com. That's one word, T-A-L-K-B-O-R-D-E-R. And finally, I am a senior fellow with a wonderful organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. Their terrific website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. You know, they are located, as they would like to tell you, in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. Beautiful place to be, right on the Pacific coast. Here I am on the East Coast, but through the magic of computers, telephones, and an occasional airplane ticket, I have been working with those folks for a number of years. They're doing a great job in trying to get a clear message out there so that people understand the real dangers that we face by not securing our borders against unlawful entry, by not enforcing the immigration laws that at their foundation were designed and intended to do just two things, folks: protect innocent lives and protect the jobs of hardworking American families, irregardless of ethnicity. I don't know how it has happened, but somehow the open borders folks, I call them the immigration anarchists, try to portray this thing as an issue of xenophobia, racism, or worse. In point of fact, the immigration laws make no such distinction. The only distinction that those laws make is between American citizens and folks who are not citizens. And there's a word for people who are not citizens. It's called an alien. It's not an insult. In fact, under the Immigration and Nationality Act, that's that all-encompassing body of law, the term alien simply means any person not a citizen or national of the United States. And I like to keep on reiterating that point because I will use the term alien. It is a correct and accurate term, and it is a term that is used by virtually every other country on the planet. The problem with the word alien for the immigration anarchists, let's be honest about this, we need honesty today, is that it provides clarity at a time that the last thing they want is clarity, because they know that the facts, the law, common sense, and morality are all on our side, on the side of those of us who believe in secure borders and believe that we need to enforce immigration laws that are designed to keep people out of the country who would do harm to us, whether they're criminals, whether they suffer dangerous communicable diseases or mental illness and are violent or sex offenders, human rights violators, war criminals, spies, terrorists, and, of course, aliens who would also take the jobs that Americans desperately need. Before we get into that, I want you to know that I have an amazing guest joining me today. His name is Jerry Casale. Jerry and I go back over 40 years. We first met when we were both inspectors with the Immigration Service at Kennedy Airport, and our careers then took different paths. But before we get into that, let me bring him on. Jerry Casale, happy Friday. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Mike.
It's always good to chat with you on air or off air, but in particular, I'm thrilled that you're joining us for our conversation this Friday evening. April the 5th, spring has sprung, and I think Washington is coming unglued. How's that for an assessment?
It sounds like you're right on cue. I just attended downtown a session where our former commissioner, Ms. Meisner, was schmoozing with the newly appointed Mexican ambassador, and you'd never know we have any problems here.
Not at all. Perish the thought. Everything is under control. And if you don't believe Doris Meisner, then just ask Janet Napolitano. Remarkable, isn't it? And by the way, I don't know if I sent you the article. I think some of you folks out there might find this interesting. Guess what happened to the virtual fence, the Secure Border Initiative Network? They are selling off the cameras on eBay. I kid you not. You cannot make this stuff up. How is that for a great news bulletin on Friday, right after there was an LA Times story about how drones with radar are now showing that probably double the number of illegal aliens are running the border than Ms. Napolitano was willing to accept blame. Well, she never accepts blame. You know, she's the only woman I know who's very good at snatching victory from the jaws of defeat, at least in theory, of course, not in reality. But how does that make you feel that they're selling off the cameras for $100,000 when it cost us God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars to put those cameras up on the border? Isn't that typical?
Could it be that the last election is over, Mike?
It could be, and, you know, let's not get in the way of that stampede of folks headed this way hoping to participate in comprehensive immigration reform. It's kind of like dangling a steak in front of somebody who hasn't eaten in a while. You know, I became a special agent. You and I actually were examiners together, as they used to call adjudications offices, back with Dick Guthrie and the other merry band of adjudicators back in the New York District Office in the mid-70s. But from there, I became an agent, and you stayed with the examinations program, the adjudications program. Why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of how you spent your career with the INS so that my audience understands? Because my goal, folks, is to provide true experts. Unlike TV, they like to bring in people who did a study, and in 3 weeks they've learned all that they think they will ever need to learn. Those of us who've been in the trenches for decades have a very different view of the issue. Certainly you have done your time in the trenches, Jerry. So why don't you tell my audience what mischief you've been up to in your career?
Well, it's interesting because I thought that administering the actual benefits that the agency gives to those who are qualified for either temporary residence in the U.S. or permanent residence or eventually even citizenship, that's like the top of the kinds of things that our government can give to any foreign person. And so that seemed a fascinating thing to stay with when I was getting started, although there were people recruiting for investigators. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened had I made the other choice. But at the time, we started out simply doing airport inspections, which was a very good introduction, as you remember.
Uh-huh.
It was a treadmill when you had a number of flights coming in. And that was a very good foretaste of some of the things, that so many officers would have to deal with in their lives if they stayed with it.
Well, do you remember looking at the board when we came into the International Rivals Building and they would post how many flights were expected that day, and you would think, dear God, we're really in for it today.
Indeed, that was really something. So, but I became... Oh, what was that?
No, I'm just going to say, in a manner of speaking, the way I described those 4 years for me, and I guess it was roughly the same amount of time for you as an inspector, I said that we had our eye to the peephole on America's front door, because really that's what the job was. The job was, in a minute or so, to try to determine whether or not to permit an alien into the United States, not based on race or religion or ethnicity, but based on the law, which, again, at its foundation, was designed to weed out people whose presence would be harmful. Back then in the 70s, I guess the biggest concern we had were people working. Today, of course, different world, different threats. There's concerns about terrorism. There's concerns about transnational criminals. I mean, we had criminals back then, but not on the scale that we do today. But it was all about enforcing laws that were clearly written to protect the lives and jobs of Americans. Would that be a fair assessment to your judgment?
Yes, it was, and it was quite an interesting baptism for us, because most of us had come out of college or other lines of work to become inspectors, and we were most of us very young at that time, and It was amazing being an ordinary American and getting into this kind of work to realize that there were people, and many people, who would be willing, if it came to it, to say things or present documents that were not true to get what they wanted.
Are you trying to say they lied to us, Jerry?
Well, it is amazing because as it happened in my life, as a kid even, I'd always been interested in the history of our country and what was it that, you know, made America tick. And I thought I had a pretty good handle on it, but I realized when I started out with the Immigration Service that I didn't really know anything about the background of why we had these laws, what they did or were trying to do, you know, for the interest of the American public. And it was quite a steep learning curve.
Wasn't it? And it seemed like so much of what we did was about creating illusions of security that weren't matched by what we were doing or with what our facilities were. You know, I remember, I was very humbled. We used to have this big blue binder. It was a loose leaf. It was called the Service Lookout Book, or the SLOB, as it was known. And I remember one day these Japanese businessmen came in, and it was funny because culturally everybody was very different. The Brits and the Japanese would tend to walk almost in a single line, almost kind of like ducks following one behind the other, where the folks from the Mediterranean would form an immediate mob scene outside your booth, if you recall. Mm-hmm. And back then they didn't have the cattle line, so you would have a distinct line in front of each inspector's booth. And I had these Japanese businessmen come into my booth, and they were absolutely shocked that even back in the 70s, we didn't have computers in those booths, because they told me that in Japan they had already computerized. So here I was thinking, wow, I work for the U.S. government, and here I am with a loose leaf binder, and I'm being told by some Japanese businessmen that they had gone to computers. What was wrong with us? It was kind of a rude awakening, you know?
Yes, we'd have to keep these binders up by hand in the early days ourselves. Every now and then, a few
all
more
laid
would
out
come.
On the desks, and we would have
pull
to change
this out,
them,
put that
periodically.
In. Yes.
It was the Stone Age. All that was missing was a hammer, chisel, and tablets.
Yes.
But it was an interesting experience. Jerry and I were taking a little walk through memory lane last night, and I told them one of my funny stories that I remembered, where a woman came into my booth, and she threw down the passport for herself and her husband. And I think the guy's name was Herman or something. And I said, you know, when your husband gets out of the bathroom, ma'am, we'll take care of both of you, because I can't inspect just the passport. And she looked very surprised and said, well, just a second, my husband's right here with me. Now, I didn't think she was married to the invisible man, and I looked at her, and I said, well, where is he? Whereupon she reached into the satchel she was carrying, pulled out an urn. I kid you not, folks, it had the human remains, the ashes of her deceased husband who had been cremated, and there I am staring at an urn with a passport that belonged to this poor guy who had recently passed away, and she insisted that she would never travel anywhere without her husband. I just don't even want to imagine what the conversation that she had with him was like on the airplane.
Well, at least he didn't talk back, probably, sir.
Probably not. Probably not. What was probably your wackiest recollection of...
Well, I don't think I can top that one, Mike.
It is a difficult one to top, I admit that.
No, there were all kinds of interesting things, but they were various. Some of them I remember best, of course, relate to times later on, after I moved on to regular adjudications and eventually naturalizing people to citizenship. Which,
I'll give one other semi-humorous story, and we'll move on, because I try not to be boring. I tell people that if you get in front of a microphone or an audience, you don't want to be accused of being an unlicensed anesthesiologist. You know, we had to have Spanish language training, which has been dropped from, I guess it has been dropped from the curriculum at the academy, which blows my mind. But at the airport, we also had translators who the airlines would provide and so forth. But I remember one of our buddies, Tom Triolo, had this guy in front of him in what we call secondary, where you send people for more detailed examination. You might go through their bags and so forth. And they were asking this guy from Colombia why he had come to the United States. And in Spanish, he said, para comprar otro pie, which means to buy another foot, which made no sense. And we're trying to figure out what in the world he was talking about. And Tommy is questioning him, and he calls me over. He said, Mike, is your Spanish any better than mine? I don't understand this guy. And we're going back and forth for about 5 minutes with this guy who insisted that he had come to America to buy another foot. And the guy got really upset with us and reached his down and grabbed his leg and yanked it off. He was wearing a prosthetic leg. And I said, I think I've now seen it all.
I don't even know if 2 years of Spanish would have gotten you past that one right away. But
well, probably so, but it was just one of those wacky things. And, of course, we had lots of people who were smuggling drugs. We had people who were swallowing narcotics. And, in fact, we hear about it now if you watch Border Wars, and they're talking about what a revelation to see people swallowing either balloons or condoms stuffed with cocaine or heroin. Out at the airport, we had this going on back in the 70s. And, you know, what this really reinforces, folks, and it's a very important point, and I've been making this point wherever I go because we keep hearing about the mythical four border states, California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. In point of fact, New York, in my judgment, is as much a border state as are any other states. Any state that has a seaport, it lies along the northern or southern borders, or has an international airport, has to be considered a border state. And, of course, New York State qualifies on all counts. So we really need to understand that we don't simply have a problem with people running the Mexican border, which gets us to the Gang of Eight, or as I now call them, the Eight Gangsters. Let's really be accurate about who they are and what they're doing behind closed doors. The Eight Gangsters are saying, we're going to secure the border. And I want to know which border they're talking about, because we have 50 states that are border states. Your thoughts?
Well, yes. I mean, I just took a trip, for example, through New England to see some old friends. And everywhere I went, there were significant presence of people who, not so long ago, you know, would not be seen except as an occasional, you know, colorful accent thing. But
yep.
I was in St. Albans, Vermont. And there were very large numbers of, you know, Central American and other kinds of, restaurants, people and all the like. Portland, Maine had a lot of people from Somalians and the West Indies who were, by the way, looked to by the city of Portland as a way of increasing their receipts from the U.S. government. Because these people had been given some sort of, you know, special asylum or whatever status. And so merely by being present, they were hoping that this was going to kind of bring cash into this depressed area.
You know, it's funny. My mother, may she rest in peace, came to the United States from Poland ahead of the Holocaust. And she said that back in Europe, people were told that the streets of America were paved with gold. Today, the gold isn't to be found in the street, but maybe in the post box when they mail the checks out. I've never seen a situation where a government has been more willing to provide financial assistance to people, truthfully, irrespective of their immigration status in the United States. And it just seems kind of bizarre that at a time that our economy is struggling, and let's get to the point I started to make, when I started my program today, they were issuing it's actually the beginning of the month, so they have the end of month statistics for March, and they said, well, this is good news, bad news, or really maybe not so good news, bad news. Unemployment dropped to 7.6%, which sounds good, but of course, part of it is because of all the people who've just thrown up their hands and have stopped looking and maybe ran out of unemployment benefits. But the number that worried everybody was that last month 88,000 new jobs were created. They were hoping for 200,000. And the point that I make is that we are gaining over 200,000 foreign workers every month when you realize that between lawful immigrants, about 100,000 per month, people with temporary work visas, perhaps another 50 or 60,000 a month, and God knows how many tens of thousands of illegal aliens who make it into the United States by running the border, violating the terms of their visas and so forth. Bottom line, we are winding up with more foreign workers each and every month than the number of jobs that are being created by the economy. And this is why we are in a no-win situation. American workers are being made to run up an increasingly rapidly moving down escalator. Would you agree with my assessment, Jerry?
Yes, and I was reminded of another interesting thing. We routinely used to recite to prospective applicants for U.S. citizenship that once they became citizens, they'd have the benefit of actually voting and helping to elect their representatives either in state or local or national government.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that some years ago already, a piece of national legislation had created a situation where we now have an honor system. So if you claim you're a citizen, you sign up and you vote.
Well, you know, and the president...
So who are the American people now in a scenario like that? Are they really U.S. citizens? We don't know any longer.
No, and what
we have
know,
no way
ever.
Of knowing unless the, you know, it's all a matter of what you say.
Well, you know, it's funny because President Obama, by executive action, here we go again, by royal decree, if you will, is going to create an election system that the federal government will monitor to make certain that people get to vote, even if they can't speak English. They are not to be challenged in the voting booth. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
you were doing naturalization.
Yes.
I know that English literacy was one of the prerequisites for naturalizing as long as the alien in question, the person seeking naturalization, was, I believe, under the age of 55. Am I correct on that one?
Oh, yes. And it's various combinations even above that because it was considered and is truly a measure of whether you can communicate with your fellow citizens
right.
and be
so
an
now,
actual
here's my point.
Contributing member.
If you
yes.
can't read or write or speak English, might it call into question what your citizenship is?
Yes, it would have before, but now apparently all you have to do is check the block that I am one, and nobody's allowed to question you. I questioned my electoral people at the polling place recently, and they said, that's right, we are forbidden here in Maryland to demand documentation to show that you really are a citizen. We cannot
well, what,
do
sorry,
it.
So now
we're
here's
forbidden.
My question. Without documentation, what prevents somebody from voting regularly and often, maybe casting 10 ballots under 10 different names?
What indeed?
You know, folks, understand the problem that we're facing. Often enough, Americans don't vote. My concern is that by not voting and by having foreign nationals who are voting, our government is being elected by people who have a vested interest in driving our country off the road. This is the real significance to this situation, that you will have illegal aliens voting for programs that might be advantageous to their home countries, but not advantageous to the United States. That's the whole idea to showing allegiance to a country, that what's good for the country should be good for its citizens and vice versa. That's what Abraham Lincoln meant when he talked about a government by the people, of the people, and for the people, that there was this synergy, there was this symbiotic relationship. And today, of course, it would seem that representation isn't so much for the citizens, but for the wealthy and for the corporations through campaign finance. We are selling our government, and all too many of our fellow Americans seem to be asleep at the switch, more concerned with who's winning Dancing with the Stars or who might win the pennant this year now that baseball has started up, than worrying about what the future of America and our future and our children and grandchildren's future might look like. Is that not an unreasonable concern?
That's really something very interesting because history, you know, when you look at it, what's happened to other great civilizations and so forth, it's pretty unforgiving. I mean, a country like ours has enormous advantages and resources that we've inherited and a way of life that keeps that moving forward if only we will pay attention. But if you don't,
well,
you know, there's no guarantee. In fact, you can practically guarantee that it won't continue, because the norm is for things to fall apart if they're not guarded and maintained by people who understand what's at stake.
Well, you said that history is unforgiving. I always think in analogies. I would say that history is about as unforgiving as gravity. And to anybody who's ever taken a serious spill or seen an airplane fall out of the sky, the fall doesn't hurt. It's that sudden stop that gets you, you know. And I fear that that's the direction we're headed. It's the first time in generations.
You step off a precipice and you change your mind, it's too bad.
Yeah, well, you know, ask Wile E. Coyote in mid-fall. It doesn't work. You know, once you hit that tipping point and you're off the cliff, there's no going back. And that's what I really fear about. And, you know, this isn't about xenophobia, folks. America is great because of its diversity. I'm a New Yorker. I live in the most diverse city, certainly in America, perhaps the world. I love the diversity. I love that a couple of days ago my wife and I stopped into a nice little restaurant, and we had a nice Vietnamese meal. You could have any kind of food, listen to any kind of music. It enriches us to be exposed to the cultures of people from all over the world. This isn't about living in an enclave where everybody is white bread. This is about making certain, though, that we look after our own children, our own citizens of every race. And, you know, if you look at the unemployment rate, going back to the 88,000 jobs that were created, it's bad for all Americans. It's even worse for Americans who happen to be black or Latino. And so how this became a race issue, that if you want the laws enforced, somehow this is about race, this is about protecting Americans. And that's irrespective of ethnicity, of race, religion, culture. It's about Americans. And that's why that word alien is so darn important. And you know, you were bestowing citizenship upon people, and we both were involved with providing residency to folks who got married, and we saw the shenanigans that went on with the lawyers that were arranging the marriages and the notary publics and so forth. I don't know if you remember, Jerry, but I was working with Gary Hittleman way back when, and we uncovered a marriage fraud ring with an attorney by the name of Chu. And he was arranging marriages, I kid you not, well, this won't shock you, it may make the folks out there have a little giggle, but this guy was arranging marriages between Chinese crew members on ships who were marrying young ladies who were Puerto Rican lesbian hookers. I kid you not, that's exactly what it turned out that they were, and it led to my first appearance at a federal trial. And the newspapers were out in force, the TV was there, because it had everything you could want in a story. It involved a lawyer on trial, it involved prostitution, it involved immigration, and it involved an attorney who was one of the most storied defense attorneys at the time. So, you know, the idea was this really captured everyone's imagination. But we saw all kinds of stuff. I mean, I had a woman who, every time I asked her a question, had to light up a cigarette to give me an answer. She went through two packs of cigarettes, and I finally grabbed her matchbook. And I realized that her matchbook was a crib sheet. She had all of the answers to any question you could ever want scribbled on this very, very big matchbook that had, like, you know, 50 matches in it. It was a big, broad thing. There was another guy who I said, raise your right hand so I could place them under oath, and the person insisted on raising his left hand. And it dawned on me that the guy was a southpaw, because in the palm of the other hand was his notes. So, and I'm sure you encountered the same thing as an adjudicator. So we saw people trying to con their way to either get paid for marrying an alien for money or some other remuneration, or the alien who wanted to beat the system and get a green card so that they could bring their real spouse and kids to the United States ultimately.
I remember an illustration of that from the time when I moved on to the Boston office as an adjudicator. Nobody knew what to do with this guy who suddenly appeared and wanted to be processed as a petitioner for a wife who had been living in China for about 30 years. And I looked into his file, and this fellow was the beneficiary of what was, in those old days, one of the pilot programs for putting the record straight and clearing it up by being nice. It was called the Chinese Confession Program.
I remember that.
And this was apparently in its full vigor in the earliest part of the 60s, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Maybe the late 50s, maybe it got... But in any case, he had confessed basically that he'd gotten into the U.S. by fraud, by pretending to be the son of a citizen, which in the early days, with the restrictions on Chinese immigration, you had to be in order to be there. So now he was coming forward and saying that the wife he'd claimed all these years was not really his wife. He already had a wife in China from many years ago, which at the time would have disqualified him from being the unmarried son of a citizen, etc. So in other words, having gotten the benefit through fraud twice, the first time and the second time during his confession in the 60s, he wanted to import a woman who now he claims is really his wife. And in those days, and probably even now, you can manufacture documents like that on demand in China. So he was going for the third ring, you know, of benefits.
Wow.
to import somebody who might or might not have actually ever been his wife.
That's mind-boggling.
So the idea that, you know, there are people who are basically always going to be really level, you know, and essentially honest, except for maybe an unfortunate situation that caused them to be desperate, that might apply, but you can't depend on it. There are other people who simply, you give them another chance to cheat or you know, bend the rules to get something else that they want, including, of course, money from other aliens who want to come in. They're going to keep doing it as long as the system invites them to do it.
And, you know, back in the 70s when you and I worked for Dick Guthrie those were our formative years with the agency, with the INS, the Immigration Naturalization mm-hmm. Service, that, of course, has now been supplanted by Citizenship and Immigration Services, ICE and CBP, all under DHS, an
mm-hmm.
agency that I have no problem describing as the Department of Homeland Surrender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a document that I quoted when I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing just this past March 20th, and I made note of it several times because I can't overemphasize this enough. You know, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, and the 9/11 Commission staff issued a 9/11 Commission staff report in addition to the 9/11 report because they felt so strongly about the immigration component to the contributing factors of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. So I'm going to read two brief paragraphs, and I know you're going to be familiar with this, Jerry, but I want to make sure that all of you folks who are spending Friday with us this evening can hear this. I really want you to pay attention. Now, this comes, again, from the staff that worked with the 9/11 Commission and talked about the dangers that immigration posed to national security by not doing it right. This starts out, this is the very first paragraph in the preface, and it's a big volume, and if you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, if you go to capsweb.org, you can read the documentation, you can find the link, you can download the entire 9/11 Commission report and the staff report for free. It's public record, it's a voluminous report, it has lots of facts in there. If you want the facts, I recommend you look at it. Understand the real significance of immigration in this dangerous era. But here is how this staff report starts out. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after the 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy, we believe, for reasons that we discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. And then they go on and explain why this has to happen. And let me tell you, folks, it still hasn't happened 11 years after 9/11. Now, let's talk about immigration benefits, is what you're describing, providing a green card, providing citizenship. And, you know, in March of 2002, I was pulling into my driveway. I will never forget that day. And I got a phone call from Sheila Jackson Lee's counsel. And at the time, Sheila Jackson Lee was the minority member, the ranking member of the Immigration Subcommittee. And what I mean by that, if you're not familiar with the jargon of Congress, the minority member or the ranking member is the person who belongs to the party that doesn't have the majority in Congress. So right now in the Senate, the Republicans are the minority party. In the House, the Democrats are the minority party. So Sheila Jackson Lee was part of the Democrat Party. The Democrats did not have that majority. And her counsel, a guy by the name of Leon Buck, called me up and said, we need you in Washington because we just found out that two of the dead terrorists, Mohammed Atta and Marwan Al-Shehhi, were granted authorization to attend flight school in the United States. And this is 6 months to the day after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. If you want to talk about a major screw-up, this was it. And I was at that hearing. It's posted on C-SPAN permanently, or you can go to michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org. It's up there. This was an amazing hearing. And I found myself with three other witnesses, Rudy Decker, the guy that ran the flight school, the guy from the computer company that issued the letter, and, of course, good old Mr. Ziegler, the immigration commissioner back then, trying to figure out how in the world, 6 months after everybody and his brother knew that these two guys had been terrorists and that they were dead, the old INS saw fit to bestow upon them authority to go to flight school. And so let's get to immigration benefits. And this is amazing.
Yes.
And this is to be found on page 98 under the title Immigration Benefits. And here it is. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11 hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire the necessary materials, and execute an attack. So this report lays it out. There's no fuzziness here. There's no ambiguity. Nobody has to read between the lines. You know, so many times, and you've seen these reports, Jerry, you read 20 pages, you sit there scratching your head. It's like a politician's speech. You know the guy just spoke for a half hour, but you don't know what in blazes he's talking about. These folks laid it out concisely, clearly, put it right in front of everyone's face and said, here it is. You give benefits to people, and terrorists will take that opportunity to embed themselves, or as I like to say, hide in plain sight. So you were there at headquarters after 9/11, right?
Yes.
Do you think...
I did an inspection. I was sent periodically to do field inspections to discuss, you know, how,
okay, so now
how
here's
the
my
flow
question.
Of adjudication... Yes.
All right, so you're doing field inspections to make sure that the field offices around the country were living up to standards. And you,
yes.
you just heard this. Do you, what are your thoughts, first of all, about what the 9/11 Commission had to say?
Well, one thing I can't stick in my memory regarding a visit I made around that time to the New York District Office.
Okay.
And
home
I was
sweet home.
Eventually. I was eventually walked past a sealed room, which they opened for me, and it was filled floor to ceiling with a piled up files, immigration, you know, application files.
You never told me this story, Jerry. This is getting better than I thought, or worse.
And they told me Well, you know, at this time they realized I was actually interested in the actual conditions rather than being told what I wanted to hear as a representative of headquarters. And they told me that the illegal aliens and their handlers, you know, the attorneys and all the others, had realized that because of the backlogs that were overwhelming the Immigration Service of applications for permanent residence in this case, that it was worth it to any illegal alien to simply file an application for permanent residence without any basis for it, because they could calculate that it would take at least a year and a half and possibly two or more years before the agency examiners would have a chance to even look at it. In the meantime, under the current guidelines, these people were granted full authorization to be here, to work here, and everything else while they were waiting for somebody to scrutinize their actual application. And they said when that time came, the alien simply disappeared. He melted into the woodwork. He never showed up for the interview because there was nothing to actually base his claim to permanent residence on.
Well, now let me ask you a question, though.
Because he just bought time by paying the fee.
Yeah, now here's the point.
2 years of being embedded and working in the U.S.
Well, and now, meanwhile, they also immediately, once they got that temporary benefit, couldn't they get a Social Security card and a driver's license and create a whole new identity for themselves?
Sure, why not?
Would this have been around 2005?
It was probably a little farther back in time than that.
Okay, well, I'll tell you why. I want to read to you a headline that appeared on November 29th, 2006. I feel like we're about to do that TV show, This Is Your Life. Well, this is the life of the Immigration Service.
Mm-hmm.
November 29th, 2006, the Washington Post, okay, ran an article that was entitled, are you ready for this one? Citizenship Agency lost 111,000 files.
Mm.
And it went on and talked about how of the 111,000 files, they all related to applications for various benefits, including 30,000 applications for U.S. citizenship that were adjudicated without the files, according to the GAO, by the way.
Yes.
Doesn't that
yep.
blow your mind when you think about what the 9/11 Commission warned, that by applying for benefits, acquiring citizenship, this was the key embedding tactic of the people who killed 3,000 innocent victims on September 11, 2001. This was the tactic of other terrorists that we've seen in the news, the Times Square bomber and the other dirtbags that have tried to kill people in America. They became citizens. They used citizenship as an embedding tactic. And now, 4 years after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Citizenship Agency lost 111,000 files. Last year, by the way, Jerry, the GAO issued a study about foreign students and said that there were, I think it's 30,000 schools that are authorized to issue the I-20. The I-20, folks, is the form a school fills out so that a foreign student can get a student visa. They said that 38% of the flight schools had yet to file the appropriate applications with the FAA 10 years after 9/11. And they even identified at least one flight school that was owned and operated by illegal aliens, training more illegal aliens as to how to fly airplanes inside the United States a decade after 9/11. It's infuriating, but does it surprise you?
It does not anymore.
Now, tell me something. They are talking about, and you were there for the 86 fiasco, the Reagan amnesty under IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act.
Oh, you mean the one where we're forbidden to ask any questions about whether they have met the qualifications?
That's the one, and where we weren't allowed to share information in the files with other law enforcement. You know, I had an FBI agent come to me one day. And he said to me, Mike, I'm looking for a guy who's committed homicides. I need his file. Do you know what the guy looks like? I had all that material. I had the guy's file. But it was under that red flag that said you may not share it. And I turned to this bureau agent and said, I got the file, but if I give it to you, at the least I'm going to lose my job, and at the worst I go to jail. I told him that he had to go to a judge and get a court order. Meanwhile, they're looking for a guy who's out there killing people. We were not allowed to share the data with the FBI, with DEA, or with homicide detectives under any circumstances unless we had a court order. It was a confidentiality deal. And by the way, if the alien had come here legally and did everything according to law, then we had to show every piece of paper to anybody from any other law enforcement organization. But if they violated the law and lied about it, they were protected from anybody finding anything out about them, including the FBI or DEA or any other law enforcement agency. What insanity are we dealing with here, Jerry? And back then we were told we would have about 1 million aliens. We wound up with 3.5 to 4 million. We believe many of these folks came here way after the cutoff date. And now we're being told 12 million. If history repeats itself, God forbid, we could wind up with between 30 and 40 million aliens applying for lawful status. What do you think the integrity will look like? Do you think there could be any possible way of doing this with the slimmest amount of integrity? Or do you think they're just going to do this on face value in the file? Your experience, your hunch.
No, because they have all the slogans in place, and the slogans are what drive, you know, the policies, not the facts.
What slogans?
Oh, coming out of the shadows, the Dream Act,
So you're telling me that there's a good chance that people will use false names and not be detected for using false names. Does that sound about right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what's the likelihood that terrorists would be able to easily embed themselves with this program that they're talking about creating, these eight gangsters who are hiding in
the room? Well, I'm sure you'll agree with me is what amazes me these days is we haven't had more serious incidents yet. That remind us of the 9/11 incidents, because we really are not protected.
Doesn't this disturb you and infuriate you? I mean, this stuff keeps me awake at night. I don't know how badly it affects you, but having lived through 9/11, there are nights I frankly don't sleep. I lie down, and an hour later, maybe I dozed off, and I'm sitting bolt upright in bed thinking about the madness. Am I being crazy for being worried that this could again lead to more terrorist attacks? And by the way, something that I want you folks to know, because, you know, we're hearing the wonders of previous administrations. May 20th, 1997 is a date that I will personally never forget, because it was on that date that Lamar Smith, who at the time was chairing the Immigration Subcommittee in the House of Representatives, called me along with Henry Hyde, who passed away since, but Henry Hyde chaired the House Judiciary Committee. I was called to testify about immigration visa fraud and benefit fraud because of the two terrorist attacks that happened in 1993. First, you have Kanzi, a Pakistani national who had applied for political asylum. He repaid our kindness by standing outside CIA headquarters with an AK-47. I believe it was January 26, 1993. Opened fire on the vehicles being driven by CIA employees coming to work, killed two, yep. Wounded three, fled the country, which is one of the advantages foreign nationals have. They have a trap door they can escape through, except we dragged them back, put them on trial, and executed them ultimately. But the people he killed remained dead. The people he injured remained injured. And 1 month later, February 26, 1993, first attack at the World Trade Center, nearly toppled the tower sideways, which probably would have cost hundreds of thousands of dead bodies, and would have probably made Lower Manhattan uninhabitable to this day. The Clinton administration did absolutely less than nothing. What do I mean by less than nothing? They did Citizenship USA, where they ran over 1 million applications through the bureaucratic machinery. It went through faster than crap goes through a goose. Am I describing it improperly, or would you agree with my assessment?
What about it? Yes, I'm sorry. I was in headquarters at the time that was being pushed through, and it had top priority.
By the way, my friend Neil Jacobs from Dallas called it the Jiffy Lube process. He was the chief of investigations in Dallas, and he was promptly removed as the chief of investigations in Dallas. but he called it Jiffy Lube. Is that a fair term?
I think so. It's interesting that when I came from the field offices to headquarters in 93, I originally said that the place I really wanted to work in was citizenship and naturalization, because that seemed, you know, like the top benefit we can give. And I was interested to see more of how it could be handled at the headquarters level. I was warned by people who were sympathetic that I shouldn't get involved in it at all at that point. And I could see later on why they gave that advice, because it was being directed from the White House. They imported
Al
people
Gore
into headquarters.
Al Gore was directing it.
Well, yes.
I mean, that's what the GAO and OIG reports talked about, and my understanding was that they were threatening district directors with being fired if they didn't meet their quota.
Yep.
Now, let's get to another point that the last time you were on my program, I want to make this point again, and I want you folks to listen to this. And by the way, I want everybody who's listening to my program, and again, I'll remind you that I've got an old colleague and a good friend of mine, Jerry Casale, on the line with me here. He's a former INS agent, or officer rather. He was an adjudications officer, and we were inspectors together at JFK in the dim distant past at the beginning of our careers. And if you find that what we're telling you is disturbing to you, if you find it eye-opening, there's going to be a podcast of this program posted. I want you to recommend that all of your friends and all of your neighbors and the people who disagree with you go to the website. I don't take any pleasure in beating the crap out of the old INS. I don't think that Jerry does either. But this is cautionary. We are living in a perilous era, and the eight gangsters are about to attempt to foist a catastrophe on America. If Americans can't find work now, I'd love to know what will happen when tens of millions, potentially, foreign workers are granted legal status and equal right to work as Americans who are unemployed right now. I want to know how we will deal with the national security issues that this catastrophic nonsense will create, or opportunities for criminals to enter the country and embed themselves will cause for America. We are not Chicken Little, but it would seem the sky almost is falling. But there's a point that I want everybody to understand. During the State of the Union address, when President Obama made that point about clearing up the backlogs, making the bureaucracy more efficient, and everyone says, well, we got to make the bureaucracy efficient. Jerry, is there a difference in the length of time that it takes to process an application if you approve an application versus deny an application for a benefit like citizenship or residency?
That is usually a key to making your career advance, if there is any, to find ways to agree to approve things and don't ask too many questions.
Okay. Now, is it easier to approve or easier to deny an application?
Both. Multiples of difference between approval and denial. Denials have to be reviewed for the factual background. They have to then be written up. The officer who recommends the denial has to be ready to prepare what will probably be the result if it's appealed, and so on. Meanwhile, an approval is almost, in theory, it's reviewed, but in fact, this hardly ever happens unless, of course, something hits the fan like 9/11.
So what you're basically saying is it fair? Is it fair to make the following statement? An application for a benefit, whether it's citizenship, whether it's residency, can be approved in 30 minutes, an hour, whatever, but a denial might take hours or days to get through the system.
Yes.
Okay. So if I went to you, if I was your boss and you're at headquarters, and I know that you're happy to be retired as I am, but if I was your evil boss and I would say to you, Officer Casale, we are adamant about weeding out the fraud because this is about national security. You have to do everything in your power to eliminate fraud, identify it, and nail the bums. But also remember, we want you to process 30 applications a day or some such figure.
Yes.
Does that kind of conversation ever happen?
That was a continual theme throughout my career.
Okay.
But,
so yeah. Now what does that mean in practicality? What do they translate that for the folks who never worked for the old INS or for USCIS?
Well, what it usually amounted to as a practical matter is that for, you know, if you had any pride at all in your professionalism, you would eat a number of possibilities every day that you were making a mistake in not looking into something that you had no time to look into, but you would focus on at least a few cases that were clearly really bad, and that would be the extent of what.
So you knew that you were approving cases that shouldn't have been approved only because you were Lucy at the Bonbon Factory, in a manner of speaking, and you couldn't eat all the candies going by on the conveyor belt.
Right, and of course, after a while, year after year, the officer lives in the sense of reality. You know, I have this as my job, I do the best I can, but if the people who are operating the Bonbon Factory set these unrealistic requirements, obviously I'm going to miss some because there isn't enough time and there's no support usually for anything else but selecting a few that seem to be obviously bad.
Did you get awards for finding fraud or did you get awards for productivity? Which way did the awards generally go?
Good point, Mike. Year after year, as you probably noticed, the big awards on the field level or even the headquarters level went to people who found ways of getting more applications through the process faster.
A.K.A. take out your approval stamp.
Well, that was the only way to do it. Otherwise, you don't have the numbers.
You know, I have to tell you, I mean, listening to it all over again, I have that same knot in my stomach I used to have when I went to work every day. These aren't pleasant memories, folks, because, you see, we understood the significance of what we were doing. As an agent, I was very fortunate. I had a very diverse background. I was assigned to DEA Intelligence. I was the first immigration agent assigned there. I tripped over a terrorist plot to blow up a refinery in Israel back in 1976. Thank God we prevented that attack. I subsequently arrested other terrorists. I worked closely with the FBI and DEA, the Israeli National Police, the Canadians, the Brits, the Japanese. So I had a very exciting career on one level, but on the other level, when I came back to my own agency, we were getting beaten over the head for productivity and closing cases and pushing paper around because that was what this was all about. And so we understood very well the national security risks that we ran, but we were put in the untenable position of having to answer to a boss who got to be a boss in most cases because he didn't give a damn. He was putting his career above the safety and well-being of our country. And so I would go to work in a state of rage most of the time, knowing full well the dangers. In fact, there was one case I want to talk about before we wrap up the program. I was at the FBI. And even the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't want to get involved. Picture this kind of a case, Jerry. At the FBI, I would work shoulder to shoulder with the bureau agents. We would go on raids together. We'd make arrests together. We did surveillance together. You were part of that FBI squad, or you were part of a DEA squad. There was, you know, you had a DEA radio or an FBI radio, a call sign as an agent, and you were as much a part of the team as anybody. You weren't sitting in the office. You were out on the street doing surveillance, making the arrests, executing the warrants, sometimes getting the warrants. But what I would do is use my immigration authority on top of it to facilitate the case. We had an individual, I believe he was a citizen of Colombia. This isn't about Mexicans, folks. This happened to be a Colombian guy. And we were looking for him as a fugitive in a major drug trafficking ring. And when I opened up the guy's immigration file, I saw that he was a naturalized citizen. Underneath the G360, the biographical form, and the N400, the application for citizenship. These are all the forms that they had to fill out and that Jerry was intimately involved with. Right under it, when you lifted it up on the left side of the file, guess what was staring me in the face when I pulled his naturalization paperwork out of his file? Certified copies of convictions for felonies. Not where he was found guilty by trial and you could say, well, when he said he had never been arrested for a crime, that he really didn't do it, that he was falsely accused. Oh, no. This was a guy who numerous times pleaded guilty to firearms violations, pleaded guilty to possession of significant quantities of narcotics, pleaded guilty to criminal assault on somebody and extortion. How in the world they naturalized this guy was beyond me. Now, there's a law that says if you lie on that application, you're committing a felony by lying. So I went to the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, and the assistant U.S. attorney to whom I was speaking, his wife was about to have a baby, could have cared less. He said to me, Agent Cutler, this guy has been indicted for drug trafficking. I don't care what he lied about if he's a citizen. So be it. Now, there's a problem. In the old days, we could denaturalize somebody if you could show fraud, and you could then bring it into an immigration court. The Ninth
Circuit said
it has to be done in federal court now. The only way to strip this guy of citizenship today. Do you know what, Jerry? The U.S. Attorney's Office declined prosecution, saying to me that in their opinion, lying on an application to become a citizen by being a criminal was not a major issue that warranted further action by their office and their limited resources. I went home with I didn't know what hurt me more, my stomach or my head. I was absolutely sick to my stomach for the entire week, thinking about this fugitive. Oh, and the real sweetener to the story, he was sworn in as an American citizen while he was out on bail pending sentencing on one of those convictions where he pleaded guilty. True story.
That
then became a fugitive.
That pretty much says it all about, you know, where the priorities are in the leadership that gets appointed to administer our immigration laws. And that's, I wish I could blame it on a particular administration, but it's been going on a long time. It's just,
yes, it has.
And getting
worse.
I almost
feel like Groucho Marx when he said that he wouldn't want to belong to an organization that would have him as a member.
Yes. Yeah.
But what I want you folks out there who are listening to this conversation this evening to take away from the conversation is that there are dedicated immigration officers who are out there, whether they are adjudications officers, whether they are agents, whether they are CBP inspectors. They desperately, 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 daily want to do the best possible job because they understand how failures are placing this entire country and every American life at risk. But if they do that, their careers will wind up in the sewer. We knew it. The bosses that are there today know it. You look at Janet Napolitano, who has the brass to stand in front of cameras talking about how secure the borders are, when meanwhile hundreds of American cities today are infested by members of the vicious and extremely violent Mexican drug cartels, MS-13. You name the flavor of the month from what part of the world. It's not just about Latin America. It's the Jamaican drug posses. It's the Colombian cartels. It's Russian organized crime. It's Asian organized crime. You name the group from whatever part of the world, crime is not indigenous to one race or one group. As an agent, I've arrested people from probably three-quarters of the countries on this planet. This isn't about race. This is about protecting the lives and the jobs of Americans. Half my career was on the drug task force. So what we saw on a day-to-day basis was how the failures, the abject failures of the Reagan administration, of the Clinton administration, of the Carter administration, of the Bush administration. I'm not there now, but I can tell you that the Obama administration is the worst I've ever seen, anecdotally, from people I speak with who are still inside the agency. And people are losing their lives as a consequence, and we're being made vulnerable to more inroads being made by these transnational gangs and drug trafficking groups. and international terrorists, some of whom are undoubtedly operating in the United States, earning money by committing crime because, as one prosecutor said, that money was the mother's milk to terrorist organizations. And some of them are sitting in wherever it is they're sitting, waiting for the phone call or the tap on the shoulder, telling them that tomorrow is the day. And by the way, terrorists tend to hide in plain sight by going to the jobs that they've been doing for some time, jobs that generally provide two things, camouflage and mobility. Please understand, when I hear people bashing federal employees, the bulk of those employees are on our side. They want to do the job. It's the agency, and it's the politicians, and it's the people at the top of the food chain who serve as the greatest impediment and the greatest threat to their careers, to a level that you can't begin to imagine unless you've been there. Would you disagree with anything I just said? I know I went on for a little bit. Maybe my anger is welling up in me again when I think about the lunacy that I bore witness to during my 30-year career. But is there anything I'm saying where you're going to say, Mike Cutler, you've lost your mind and you're wrong?
It doesn't come to mind that you made any errors of basic fact in this matter. It's a bipartisan disgrace.
Did you ever get the feeling that you were selling out your oath of office because you had no choice because of the employment of the situation concerning your employment by that wacky outfit?
Well, it was kind of unfortunate. It was kind of fortunate that at a certain point I got to come to headquarters because of an old friend, you know, who I started out with in the old the early days, who had gotten higher up and so forth, appreciated for whatever reason what I could do. So I can't say that I did compromise my oath of office, but there were plenty of people around me who were much higher up who benefited by forgetting conveniently little pieces of it. And they
go along to get along?
Became our bosses, as you know.
Yes, go along to get along, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is so amazing.
I'd like to make one point.
As many as you want, Jerry. Be my guest.
Which is, there were other people, you know, that I've worked with throughout the time that I was there who were fairly cynical, and they were very ambitious and so forth, and so they weren't going to be held back by certain things. But the interesting thing is that over the years, even they were troubled by it, because even though they were, you know, playing the game and moving higher up the ladder and all the rest, you know, by just playing, you know, doing
what
they were.
Playing the game. Explain
right,
that.
Playing the game. They couldn't stand it. Every now and then they had to tell the truth, because as far as I could tell, it offended their intelligence to be repeating all this nonsense day after day. They had to occasionally indicate that they knew better. And to me, that's the one, you know, one of the sources of hope within the bureaucracy, is that people who are intelligent, who have some sense of, you know, the plain meaning of words, even if they are willing to sell out to get ahead, if they had better direction, if they had a leadership that told them to do the right thing instead of the wrong thing, they would be an asset to our country within the existing bureaucracy if they got those orders, because there's, you know, most of them are smart. There are not too many people that are actually stupid.
No, they knew where the wind was blowing. They're human weather vanes, and they go with the wind, and they go wherever it takes them, because their career was the primary issue.
But the hopeful thing, you know, from a bureaucratic point of view, which I lived within for so many years as you did, is that if the people demand it and they show it in the ballot box and so forth, or the leadership gets the message, there really could be, even now at this late date, some sort of a turnaround in terms of the people who actually have to carry out the work of these agencies that separate, you know, the people who are qualified from the people who aren't, the investigators who look into these things, and so forth. You know,
there's a wonderful Yiddish expression that says when the fish goes bad, it smells from the head. Obviously, the head rots here. You're talking about leadership at the top that's giving all the wrong orders and making the wrong priorities with the lack of resources and making certain that the mission's not being carried out to ensure integrity, but to just keep the paper moving.
Right. So there is in people who are intelligent anyway this spark that, all things being equal, they'd rather show that they are intelligent so they can figure out baloney from reality, facts from fable. So even the people who are now hurting, you know, the effort for self-interest
could be brought around. You think they could
be brought around.
Yeah. Well, you know, my dad, may rest in peace, was a smart guy. Well, both my parents were, actually. They had lots of common sense, or wisdom, as I like to say. But my dad would say, we teach people how they should treat us by demonstrating what we're willing to accept. That's why at the end of my programs, when I write commentaries, I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport. If this program tonight, if my conversation with my friend Jerry Casale has angered you, has fired you up, if you're feeling frustration, make it work. Call your neighbors, call your friends, and send them the link to my website. You'll be able to listen to a podcast of this program. I want you to send it to as many people as possible, especially your elected representatives. You know, I remember the days and weeks after 9/11, all those self-righteous, chest podium thumping politicians who stood there demanding to know why nobody connected the dots. Folks, this evening, Jerry and I have connected the dots. If, God forbid, there's another terrorist attack, that BS complaint about nobody connecting the dots will be even more hollow than ever before. It is clear that the immigration processes are designed to protect the lives of Americans, designed to enhance national security, augment what our military does, because in a manner of speaking, the men and women of all five branches of the U.S. military services are charged with keeping our enemies as far from our shores as possible. Short version, they are securing our borders externally. The DHS mission is to secure our borders internally. The failures by the DHS to live up to its responsibilities undermines the gallantry and sacrifices of the military. It's unacceptable for me. I know I'm speaking for Jerry when I say it's unacceptable for him. I am sure it's unacceptable to you. And my question to you, ladies and gentlemen, is what are you going to do about it? Are you going to just get off the computer this evening and have a cup of tea or a cold beer and say, boy, that was an upsetting program? Or are you going to say to yourself, I got to start making some phone calls. I need to become part of the solution, because if I'm not, I'm a part of the problem. I am asking you to please get involved. Please make your voice heard. Please let those people who are elected to represent you know that you demand representation. When we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food that we want to eat, the way we want it prepared. Nobody would go to a restaurant and say to some waiter or waitress, throw some crap on the plate, I'll eat it. Well, that's what we've been doing with the politicians in Washington, especially the eight gangsters, who have the chutzpah to go behind closed doors, allegedly, to formulate policy that could do irrevocable damage to national security and the future of every hardworking American. We have the responsibility to take the matter into our own hands as the laws and as our Constitution requires. This is about contacting your elected representatives and demand that they be representative of we the people. Jerry, your final thoughts for this evening? And by the way, I want to thank you so much for joining me for, it's over an hour and 15 minutes. I know that it's a Friday evening, but I just am on a mission to get our fellow Americans to understand the nature of this beast that we call immigration?
Well, I think a lot of people should owe you a debt of thanks for the years and hours and days and so forth, year after year, that you put into this effort, because so many people who went through similar experiences to yours, Mike, decided to just seek a little rest in oblivion in retirement or whatever, and not keep, you know, trying to sound the alarm and call attention.
Well, you're
very
kind
real
of,
crisis
you're kind
that
of
we're
saying
in.
It. Well, you know, and you speak about oblivion. I saw thousands of people go to their oblivion on 9/11. And I don't think anybody in New York will ever be the same. I can't get the images out of my mind, the ashes from the conflagration at Ground Zero raining down like snow in my neighborhood, my wife and I standing out there, and she said, you know, it reminds me of that scene at Schindler's List at the crematorium. I can't forget my neighbors standing on their lawns and screaming at the top of their lungs because they didn't know what happened to their husbands or their wives or their children or their parents or their brothers and sisters and best friends. You don't forget that. You don't forget that wherever you drive in New York, my hometown of Brooklyn, you see handball courts festooned with paintings that came up spontaneously of the American flag, paintings with the names of the victims, paintings of showing pictures of firefighters risking their lives, in some cases, too many cases, losing their lives. You know, you stay in New York long enough and you see fire engines race by. And you will see on the side of a fire engine the names of people who were killed, the names of their comrades who were obliterated on 9/11. And you realize that that fire engine replaced a fire engine that was obliterated on 9/11. You can't live through that, at least in Mike Cutler world. My parents were very patriotic. My mom came here ahead of the Holocaust. My grandmother died in the Holocaust. My dad was furious that the military wouldn't have him because his brother was already in the Army Air Corps. And so because of the Sullivan brothers, they wouldn't take my dad. And he worked at the Navy shipyards because he had to contribute to the war effort. He was a plumber. And he died of lung cancer in part, I believe, because he was exposed to asbestos on those ships. So I came from a family that loved this country. I love this country. And as they say in that movie Network, I'm mad as hell and I won't take it anymore, and I hope you folks out there are as mad as hell and won't take it anymore either. Jerry, we have to do this again. I don't think we can get these messages out there often enough, but please, folks, check out the podcast. In fact, what I'm going to do this evening is anybody who's on my list will get an email with the link to the podcast as soon as it's up. It may not be this evening, but as soon as it's up, I will. Please forward it to your congressmen and senators. Please forward the link to everybody you know and ask them to do the same. As I like to sometimes say, I'm trying to create a bucket brigade of truth. Jerry Casale, I wish you a wonderful weekend. I thank you
thank
so
you,
much
Mike.
For
you.
Spending some time with us.
That's
good.
Yes, it's been good to talk with you and I can salute you for all the work you've been doing for so long now.
Well, thanks, Jerry. And I know how hard you worked as an adjudicator. I know when you were at the airport, you did your best that you could do, as we all did. So I thank you for your service to our country. I thank you for your willingness to come forward and share your perspectives, your recollections, your views on where we are and where we need to be. Unfortunately, not everybody's willing to do that. So I thank you as well. So there. What more can I say? It's really a pleasure and a privilege to join you on the program today, have you on with me. And I thank you. Ladies
yes.
and gentlemen, this is going to be the conclusion of the show for this evening. I'll be back here next week, same time, same place, on the Michael Cutler Hour. We really have to take a stand, folks. Democracy truly is not a spectator sport. Please go to those three terrific websites I've asked you to go visit, michaelcutler.net, talkborder.com, and my friends over at CAPS out in Santa Barbara, K capsweb.org. Great working with them. I have a couple of articles that will be up on their website within the next day or two. Good website to visit, and it's always good to visit with all of you. So long, everybody. Good night, Jerry.
Good night, Mike.
Thank you so much, everyone. We will see you next week. Have a good weekend.